This is East End Inc. Today we present Vera Graf, reading from Virgin Territories, her book set in a Caribbean island. She was recorded at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor. Here is Vera Graf.
I should say that I'm taking you on a trip today to the Caribbean of yesterday. This is not that long ago, but it really is. It was a very different time in the 1970s. And for us young people then, the world was our oyster. We decided to do crazy things, and we did them. Opening a movie theater in the Caribbean, why not? You know, showing movies to people who'd never seen movies before on these islands, sure, we'll do it. So we set out for Virgin Territories, which is the title of the book, and I'm going to take you with me. First, a little chapter of introduction on who we are. You asked me why, way back in the 1970s, I decided to become partners in opening a movie theater on a remote Caribbean island. I'd say it was written in the stars. Growing up next to Berlin's premier indie theater in the 1950s certainly helped. The Capitol was right in our backyard, and there you could watch the latest Hitchcock thriller and whatever French and Italian flicks the Capitol could get its hands on. It was one of the few theaters that showed movies in their original language, not dubbed, as the Germans prefer. Imagine John Wayne riding through the grand mesas of the American West and shouting, "Halt! Stehen bleiben!" And not only that, but with a Berlin accent. My first paid after-school job was an usher at the Cinéma Paris on Berlin's main boulevard, the Kurfürstendamm. Equipped with a brown uniform and a flashlight, I escorted patrons to their seats, desperately hoping for a tip to increase my paltry hourly wage of 90 pfennigs, about 25 cents. The Cinéma Paris took pride in showing the finest French movies of the day, and since it was the 1950s, and since everything French was very much en vogue, it showed Les Grandes Familles with Jean Gabin in the title role for an entire month. After a week on the job, I could recite the dialogue by heart because we were not allowed to leave the theater during the performance. Instead, sitting on little folding chairs, ready to usher when ushering was needed. As the weeks passed, Les Grandes Familles lost some of its luster for me, but the movie magic as a whole endured. Sometime later, I met Michael, who would be my mate and companion for 16 years. He came from a renowned family of Viennese artists and writers, and spectacles of any kind were in his blood. Dressed in a black cape, he would attend just about every performance at the small indie theater in his college town. He'd actually moved to that location in order to be near the cinema and not miss any of its performances. He loved to hold forth on Godard and the Nouvelle Vague, on Antonioni's latest, and why Pasolini's Salo was worth seeing. Later, after moving back to New York, he ditched the black cape and a lot of his student attitude, and embraced a much wider palette of films, making rooms for Hollywood movies as well as thrillers and comedies from all over the world. As much as I loved the movies themselves, the real thrill for me was sitting in a large theater with the house lights slowly dimming and the cacophony of voices and conversations fading to an expectant hush. Going to the movies with Michael was an elaborate process involving proper dressing and movie-appropriate snacks. For an Italian movie, you pulled out the cashmere. For a French film, you dressed stylish. For a Swedish, you could wear a fisherman's sweater. We never touched popcorn or any of the drinks New York movie theaters offered their patrons. Instead, we took bacon sandwiches wrapped in linen napkins to the performances. along with a silver cocktail shaker filled with Bloody Marys. We watched the films from up high on the balcony, wrapped in a dense cloud of cigarette smoke. When Michael, one day, turned to me and said, "Why don't we open a movie theater?" he didn't have to persuade me that this was a good idea. We had a little money to burn, so I enthusiastically embraced the notion. After all, I thought, life had primed both of us for the role of theater owner. And that is how the Argus Cinema on the island of Virgin Gorda was born. So you might ask, why Virgin Gorda? It's an island on the extreme edge of the Caribbean. Very few people know it. Very few people live there and lived there. And we chose it because we had been sailing by there and had fallen in love with this island. So we fly to Virgin Gorda to explore. Al Mortz used to be in the movie business in Hollywood. Now he owns a bunch of movie theaters down here in the islands over on Tortola, just across the water. Before you go any further with your theater, we are told in Virgin Gorda, you should sit down with an old movie hand like Mortz and pick his brain. Getting an appointment with a great man is far from easy. "What is the nature of your business with Mr. Mortz?" says a suspicious-sounding West Indian voice at the other end of the phone line connecting Tortola and Virgin Gorda. "Business advice," I say. "We'd like to consult with Mr. Mortz about opening a movie theater." "Mr. Mortz is a busy man," says the voice. "Is it urgent?" "Very urgent," I plead. "A lot depends on his advice." "Hmm," says the voice. And then there's nothing but silence and static on the line. I know this line well. It's a big cable, snaking like a fat eel under the Francis Drake Channel, a body of water so clean and transparent that anything buried in its depth, even at great distance, is visible to the naked eye. "He can see you Monday, 3 weeks from now," says the voice. "In the afternoon, say 3 o'clock. I had envisioned a meeting in the next few days. "Mr. Mortz is very busy," reiterates the voice. "I'm afraid I have nothing else." On the appointed day, we take the Bomba Charger ferry over to neighboring Tortola. We are dressed in our finest, I in a flowing long skirt and a pink blouse knotted at the navel, Michael in clean khakis and a faded denim shirt. We find Mr. Mortz in his office, behind a desk. No one here sits behind a desk, chewing on a cigar. A couple of large fans are battling the moist island air. The movie mogul is wearing dark slacks and a white shirt open at the collar, which has turned into a sweaty mess in the midday heat. His pink fleshy hands are massaging the desk while his little piggy eyes scan this couple of greenhorns from Virgin Gorda with mild contempt. "So you kids want to open a movie theater?" I nod. We have decided ahead of time that Michael will do the talking, because he is just better at it. Michael is never at a loss for words. They come tumbling out of him in perfect order and assembled in complete sentences. "Yes," says Michael, "and we want to do this pretty soon." "Do you?" Mortz looks amused. "Why the hell would you want to do something like that?" Michael and I exchange glances. "Because we love movies," Michael says, "and because we think Virgin Gorda is ready for things like movies and entertainment." I can see in Al Morse's face that he does not share my mate's lofty ideals. "Let me ask you something," he interrupts Michael's sermon, glancing from him to me and back again. "Have either of you ever run a movie theater? Or better, have you ever run anything?" "Quite honestly, no," says Michael, and I shake my head. "Ah," says Morse. And even if you had some experience, this is another game. Do you kids know anything about this part of the world? Do you know how things are done here, if they get done at all? We do, says Michael feebly. I give you kids a piece of advice, says Morse, leaning forward and throwing out a generous smile. Don't do it. Go to the beach, hang out at the Lord Nelson, make some friends, but don't open a movie theater. It's not going to work. Michael looks confused. Neither of us has experienced interference, has expected interference with our dream. And why not? Morse reels off the reasons. Permits are going to drive you crazy. You'll need more than a dozen licenses, and they cost. With the rent you'll be paying, and you'll be paying at least $600, if not more, you need 200 visitors a week. He leans back into his creaky office chair, mopping his brow. You'll never get that. Forget it. Best you can do is maybe 60? No, no, says Michael. We did an unofficial poll at the Lord Nelson where they all told us that they love to come to a movie theater. They'll never show, interrupts Morse. The white people will never come to your movie theater because it'll be considered a local place, and white people don't go there. As for the locals, you can't give them what they want. Do you even know what they want? Well, I do. Kung Fu and karate movies. Bruce Lee and Enter the Dragon. That's what they're into here in the islands. But with your 16mm projectors, forget about getting Kung Fu and karate films. On a roll now, the movie man goes on. How are you going to make money? Movie theaters require some initial investment, and even then they don't make money right away. We're prepared for that, says Michael, but I can see his confidence is badly shaken. We have some savings set aside just for that, to bridge the gap, so to speak. Oh, says Al Morse, as leaning forward, he's giving Michael a hard stare, and may I ask what you've budgeted for this initial investment and this gap? An impertinent question, no doubt. I wouldn't answer it. But Michael doesn't seem to mind, now that the gloves are off. About 12,000, he says. And then he volunteers some information that he usually keeps under wraps. Family money, he says, and grins towards Al Morse. To be precise, royalties. My grandfather, he was Viennese. Wrote a few plays and operas. Turned out to be lucrative for the family. Viennese? I can see a glint of excitement lighting up Al Morse's eyes. Viennese, eh? And royalties? You don't say. What was your grandfather's name? Hugo, says Michael. Hugo von Hofmannsthal. Hugo, the poet and writer of libretti. He made it all possible. You could say that by opening a movie theater, I'm continuing the family tradition. And he gives Morse a broad smile of entertaining the masses. Al Morse leans forward on his desk. Hofmannsthal, he sighs, his eyes now getting misty. What a man! And he and Strauss, what an inspired duo! They created some of my favorite operas. Der Rosenkavalier, Die Frau ohne Schatten. I grew up in Vienna, and when I was a young boy, my mother took me to the opera. Rosenkavalier was the very first one I ever saw. He leans farther forward and grabs Michael's hand. I'm thrilled and honored, he says, to meet a direct descendant of this great man. I'll do everything in my power to help you. But at the same time, I must tell you, this won't be easy. In fact, it's a foolish project. Don't say I didn't warn you. Happy and giddy, we make our way back through the streets of Road Town and back onto the ferry to Virgin Gorda. The movie theater, so far just a dream, is now within reach. Al Morse, after realizing that we will not be deterred from this foolish project, has given us many contacts. In our backpacks, we have lists of distributors and airlines, film company officials, and equipment sources. It's late afternoon, and as we are speeding on the ferry towards Virgin Gorda, the setting sun on our backs, the island seems to invite us with a golden glow from within.
This is East End Inc. We're listening to Vera Graf reading from her book Virgin Territories.
So we open, against all good advice, we open with what we think is a splash. We open with The Godfather. And they hate it. They absolutely hate it. They leave in droves. They do not like this movie. It's much too bloody. It's too violent. And we are saddened and disappointed and feel that we need to change our program. And we do. So we get tamer movies. We've learned that violence doesn't play in the Caribbean. We also hire a local projection assistant. Noah is a quick learner, and together he and Michael rise to new heights of artful projecting. From now on, there's a lot of hectic activity on the cinema balcony with its two projectors. It goes like this. Run cartoons on one projector, find the right spot on the other one to show a self-made preview of the next scheduled movie. Raise the sound and show the preview to get the audience thoroughly hooked. Lower the sound again to repeat the title and show date. Turn the lights and music on while you frantically exchange preview and cartoon reels for the first two reels of the actual movie shown that night. Noah and Michael get to be virtuosi at this, and they turn it into an elegant pas de deux, where each dancer knows exactly what to do and when to support the other one. The soundtrack is provided by Virgin Gorda's musical favorites, Barry White, Al Green, and Isaac Hayes' hit score for Shaft, which seems to electrify our audience. They, of course, have no idea of the juggling and acrobatics going on upstairs. Our moviegoers create their own magic, too. We've now gotten used to their surprising reactions, have gone beyond accusing them of being insensitive. See them as the lively and engaged people that they are. We find out that they deeply care about their movie heroes. They suffer when someone is being pursued, calling out a warning every time an assailant is lurking behind the door. Watch it, man! They shout and clap when someone gets final revenge, and they giggle uneasily during every love scene. Also, our customers are easily bored. When a film has too much dialogue and not enough action, they tune out, either falling asleep or leaving the theater. I find that it makes me nervous when they don't engage, but I soon realize that I needn't worry. Not for them, the solemn silence and utter concentration the classic movie house demands of its customers. Here, there's not only constant chatting, but also a lot of coming and going throughout the performances. No one sits through the show. Some hit the bathrooms and the concession stand, others leave and come back later. The scene has all the raucousness and movement of Elizabethan theater, all except for the cabbages being thrown at the actors. As always, Nigel at the Lord Nelson explains the situation to us. You've got to remember, he says, until the resort opened about 10 years ago, the islanders did a little fishing and farming, and there wasn't any money. Everyone was bartering. When people walked to church, they'd have their shoes tied around their necks, both to show that they owned a pair and to get a long life out of them. It seems from Nigel's account that the Virgin Gordians have only recently stepped into the 20th century and are staring in bafflement at a world made in America, a world of cars and soft drinks, Ziploc bags, and television. There's never been anything like a movie theater on this island, so there's no precedent for how to behave in one. clearly our customers are improvising and they're getting better and better at it. We have an unexpected streak of good luck. The Sound of Music has taken Virgin Gorda by storm. When the film first arrived and we screened it, we looked at each other. "We can't show that," said Michael. "Nobody will come," I said gloomily. "We could make it a children's show," suggested Michael. "And that is what we do. It gives me great satisfaction to make a poster announcing the show and to invite the children of Virgin Gorda to come to our performance free of charge. When the appointed day comes, there's a long line outside the cinema. Dozens of children have shown up in their Sunday best. The little girls have their hair done in neat cornrows, festooned with colored ribbons. Some are wearing ruched dresses. Others show up in obvious hand-me-downs from a bygone era. Little cotton smocks with faded flowers, mended and starched. Most of the boys are in their school uniforms, their faces framed by budding afros. God knows how these fashions from the United States make their way to Virgin Gorda, but they do. Many of these children look like poorer, leaner versions of their richer relatives in Philadelphia or Boston. While Michael and Noah are setting up inside, I'm outside chatting with everybody and noticing with growing anxiety that the crowd of potential moviegoers is swelling as they pour in from all directions. There must be at least 100 or more children, but there's also a steadily growing queue of hopeful grown-ups, men and women of all ages pushing and shoving. In the end, we do our free show for the children, and because of the outsized demand, we set up 2 more screenings, full charge for adults. We must have stuffed all of Virgin Gorda into the cinema. They flood the concession stand, and after the Kit Kats are gone, they go for the granola bars. They sit spellbound through the performances. They sing the songs along with the actors. And when it's over, when the curtain closes, everyone bursts into applause. On the balcony, after every show, Michael and Noah are high-fiving each other, while the Argus erupts into one big party. No one wants to go home. And then I wonder, how could the spectacle of a singing governess crooning to a bunch of blonde children on an alpine meadow in Austria be such a runaway success on this tropical island? Nobody has an answer. Not even Noah, who's not a fan of this movie and does a pretty hilarious imitation on the balcony of the singing and dancing Julie Andrews. "We should just stop ordering more movies and show The Sound of Music every night," quips Michael. And then in my direction, "How much did we make?" 512, I say. "This is good." "No, this is phenomenal. But how can we possibly keep things going in this way? God in heaven, I pray, please show me the way to more proven crowd pleasers." So I will not tell you whether God listened to our prayers, but you can probably imagine what happened. We lasted for a little while and then it was over. There weren't enough people in Virgin Gorda, so we closed. But the Argus Cinema lives on because our projectionist, who's called Noah in this book, but is really called Esau, he left the island with us. He got on a boat with us. He went to the United States with us. In those days, you could immigrate whenever you wanted and had a little stamp in your passport. We made a collection for him in New York, and we sent him to music school, to the Berklee School of Music in Boston, where he graduated with honors and then became the music teacher in Tortola, on the neighboring island. So the Argus lives on. We don't, but it does. Anyway, thank you for listening.
This is East End Ink. We heard Vera Graff reading from her book, Virgin Territories. She was recorded at Canyo's Books in Sag Harbor. Some upcoming literary events at Canyo's Books, 290 Main Street in Sag Harbor, include on Saturday, December 30th at 5 p.m., world-renowned architect Lee Skolnick speaks on his work and vision in a talk entitled Affordable Housing, One Size Does Not Fit All. More events are listed at canyosbooks.com. Today's East End Ink was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Callendrill and Catherine Zoker of Canyo's Books. This is Hazel Kahn.